So I'd like to welcome everyone to the presentation entitled WIN, a randomized trial of wellness incentive accounts for Medicaid clients with mental illness. It's my pleasure to introduce our presenters, Dina Stoner and Sam Shore. Ms. Stoner is a senior policy advisor for the Texas Department of State Health Services. She has over 35 years of experience in public policy, management, strategic planning, program design, and implementation, including a number of major initiatives in Medicaid-funded home and community-based services, acute care, managed care, and behavioral health. Mr. Shore is a consultant with TriWest Services. He received his MS in social work from the University of Texas at Austin. With over 35 years of experience in the field of mental health services and policy, Mr. Shore served as the project director for several successful SAMHSA grant projects, including Texas's Mental Health Transformation Grant, Mental Health Services for Veterans and Their Families, and a Jail Diversion and Trauma Recovery Initiative. Please join me in welcoming our presenters.
Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me okay? That usually isn't a problem. And I'm here with a false sense of bravado. It's 8 in the morning. I'm usually trying to exercise or dress or something like that, but I'm here for you. I got up at 5 this morning and marched down to Equinox, and I can tell you the vernal equinox is far away right now from this. Okay, now all I have to do is find the forward and back buttons, and we're ready to go. So we're going to talk about a project known as WIN, as Judith said, and this is providing incentives to wellness for Medicaid clients who have mental illness and some other related conditions. So when I think about WIN, we really think about what is health. And I think we've talked about this a lot yesterday. You know, we frame health in various ways. We frame health as a goal, an end. And really, health is a means to an end for our clients. And so getting back to what people want to accomplish, how they think, what they believe, is a really important part of this. And we've tried to touch on these aspects of human nature in this program and come at this from a different perspective than Medicaid programs usually approach these kinds of issues. So what is WIN? It's part of the Medicaid Incentives for Prevention of Chronic Disease grant opportunity. Yes, this came from the ACA, and yes, I'm from Texas. We do embrace the innovation parts of the ACA. We do not embrace the Medicaid expansion for some reason. So it is a competitive 5-year grant. We're one of 10 states very happy to be participating in this process. The idea behind this is to affect people's ability to practice healthy behaviors and manage chronic illnesses, the same ones that we've been discussing endlessly here, you know, stopping smoking, controlling diabetes, managing weight and blood pressure and so forth. So nothing terribly different there. We're trying to use this in a somewhat different way. So here are the 10 states, and welcome to our Texas is doing all of the chronic diseases. Why? Because we're trying to do a whole person model. Most of the projects, and they're all very wonderful and laudable projects. They do some really great stuff. Very diverse populations. Be happy you're not the national evaluator for the cross-site evaluation on this because it is very diverse. Ours is different in that we are not approaching this from a particular disease perspective. So we're not saying we're only selecting people because they have diabetes or because they have a chronic heart condition. And we are also not telling them to go to one specific intervention. So most of the projects that might send you to, say, a Loring model diabetes education program and then reward you monetarily for attending sessions. All good. What we're doing is somewhat different. We're looking at the person's motivation to be well, helping them develop a personal wellness plan that extends into their emotional health and their financial health and other aspects of their life as well, and hopefully impacts all the various things that people have. And since these are people with mental illness, tragically, they have all of these diseases are at risk for them. So here's some of our promotional literature. This project was developed with significant input from people who have mental illness in other conditions, people who met the study criteria. We did this in a different service delivery area than the one in which we implemented the project, so we didn't, you know, contaminate the study itself. But we got lots of great input from people, and it changed entirely the approach to the program the slogan, everything, and made us think about program design. Really, these sessions started out to be about how you create marketing materials. That's all good. So we stratified by age, race, sex, paid people to come in, got them a taxi ride, you know, had pizza. I don't know, that wasn't very wellness-related, but people did come, and we had a great time, did 90-minute sessions. But people had lots of other things to say, and we'll touch on this more later on. One of them was, well, what is this thing? Who's a navigator? Hey, I could be a navigator, couldn't I? Well, if I'm going to have a navigator, is it going to be the same person? Am I going to see somebody? Are they going to like me? Or is it just going to be the usual thing where I go into some clinic and somebody, a different person sees me every time? I need a relationship. I don't have a lot of those, and they're not meaningful sometimes, or they're negative, or they're all about my disease, not about me. So we learned a lot from that session. So anyway, our project, again, is importantly enough, it is a partnership with Medicaid. It's embedded in the Medicaid delivery system, and we'll touch on this several times during the presentation. Yesterday, we heard about how difficult it is to get data out of Medicaid. So our solution to that was to become Medicaid, be one with the Force, Luke Skywalker. And so we have a good relationship. Where did that come from? We have a good relationship with the Medicaid program in our state. We are the public health agency. The mental health agency is in the Health and Human Services umbrella agency. And it's all going to be reorganized soon, so don't take notes. But every few years. So anyway, we have longstanding and trust relationships with them. Both Sam and I have worked with them very intimately on a number of projects, and I think that's helpful. So because it's embedded in the Medicaid delivery system, we have a lot of advantages. We have lots of data. We have the External Quality Review Organization is our independent evaluator. And so we can do things less intrusively than would be true if we were some separate study coming in and asking for a whole, you know, separate set of data without regard to how people are usually communicating. It is a randomized controlled trial, so it is a scientific study, and it's in the Harris Service Delivery Area. That's Houston. Anybody been to Houston? Houston, we have a problem. Okay, great. So what do you remember about Houston? Anybody? It's very flat. It's very flat. It's very
big city.
It is paradoxically one of the most populated areas and the least dense urban areas in the country. So there are a lot of significant issues here. It's 12% of our SSI population, so it's our major urban area, but it's spread out so far and wide. They like to say it was a city that was invented by the automobile and made possible by air conditioning, and that is very true. That creates a lot of health issues for people trying to stay healthy. Public transportation is non-existent in some areas of town. Lots of freeways. If you don't have a car, you're not going anywhere. Climatically challenged, as we'd like to say in Texas. But it really can do kind of community in many ways. But there are food deserts, all those things we talked about before. So why'd we pick it? Because we love to torture ourselves, evidently. So we have over 1,600 people participating in the study in intervention control and comparison groups. And Sam will touch on this later. But again, working with the Medicaid office and having access to all the Medicaid data in the state allows us to have a much stronger study where we can additionally look at service areas that are not part of the study itself to see if there's any additional bias in selection that we've not detected. We did a good job of randomization, and so far things look quite good. So anyway, our target population is adults, 21 to 55. These are people who, when they enroll in the study, we didn't want to deal with dual eligibles, people on Medicare and Medicaid, because there are data issues with that, and we wanted to try to start intervening earlier in the process. So these are folks on Supplemental Security Income, SSI, in that service area, with either serious mental illness or mental health or substance use related condition, and one of those wonderful chronic illnesses that we mentioned earlier. So why are we doing this? I don't really need to reiterate the study since I think it's all embedded in our consciousness. I will say this, Texas has another negative superlative here. People die even sooner in Texas who have severe mental illness, 29 years according to that same study. Yeah, so welcome to Texas. And the leading causes of death are, of course, chronic illnesses, not suicide, not violence, not all the stereotypical things the public believes about people with mental illness, but things that we can prevent, things that we can deal with. The cost of behavioral health conditions in Texas, as in the rest of the nation, is profound on the healthcare system as a whole. Our state Medicaid office does an annual study using the 3M's algorithm of preventable readmissions. And while 9% of Texas Medicaid is all hospital setting, admissions have some relationship to mental health and substance abuse, 27% of potentially preventable readmissions are related to these conditions. So this gets the attention of the Medicaid office. I say this over and over again, and it's their own study, so it's helpful to have that. Opportunity, then, is vast. We are a managed care state. Heard yesterday there are other states headed in that direction, Illinois, and most states have been heading in that direction for some time. So we have not only acute medical care and now behavioral health, including care for SMI as of last month in managed care, but we've had long-term services and supports, HCBS services, in managed care for quite some time. And millions of people. So there are over 4 million people in the Medicaid program of all kinds. This is a huge opportunity, these kinds of studies, if successfully embedded in Medicaid systems, to impact many lives, hopefully around the country. So Sam's going to talk a little bit about organization and collaboration and lots of other good stuff.
Thank you, Dina. It's wonderful to be here and to hear the discussion we've had over the course of yesterday. Lots of good learning, lots of things that I think we can take advantage of, we've heard about. Dina and I have, you know, working as long as we have in state government, I just recently left state government and moved out of Texas. But fortunately, I still get to work on some of the policy issues back in that state. But being there that long and not screwing up too bad, we've been able to do projects that some folks haven't been as fortunate to do. And so we've realized that you have to intervene at the right level if you're going to bring something to scale, especially in a large state like ours. We've got, you know, 26 million people. The service area that we're talking about is 4 to 5 million people. That's the population. Spread out, as Dina pointed out, and it has its own culture. You know, in Houston is very different from some of the other big metropolitan areas in Texas. But one of the things that attracted us to this area for this project is they've had Dina and I worked back in the 90s on implementing the STAR Plus program, which was Medicaid managed care for SSI recipients, and so it was a pretty mature, well-established model in that community. So we knew we wouldn't be testing the implementation of managed care. We'd be testing the existing networks and providers who were used to operating in that environment and members who were used to being part of managed care plans. So one of the points I want to make with this slide is that culture, and we've heard this in some other presentations, is really important in terms of how healthcare is approached. And I'm going to talk about some other examples. But in terms of the state culture, we're not known as this bastion of liberal social policy in Texas. This is being recorded, right? So I'll be careful. And so while... while we, and, you know, I did leave Texas, so I have some safety that Dina doesn't have, so I can say some things. And we're not known as a generous state when it comes to funding social service, in spite of not being a one of the poorest states. We always compete with them for the lowest level of funding for mental health. Some of that's changing, thank goodness. But one of the cultural pieces in Texas that I recognize is that it still has a real pioneering spirit. And so trying innovative things is rewarded and is part of the culture. So we're able to try some things with the few resources we have that in some places I'm not sure you can pull off. So we're very fortunate due to the relationships that we've established over time and a little bit of credibility that to be able to pull in the Health and Human Services Commission, which is where the single state agency for Medicaid is. And so we've worked with them even though we're not currently in the same agency, we've been able to take over the operations. Dina heads that up, but they're very involved in terms of kind of owning this project. The Star Plus MCOs in Harris County, the Harris Service Delivery Area, there are three that have all of the market share, and it runs about 53,000 enrollees, did at one point. And so, you know, these three HMOs are the ones that we had to work with, and we felt like that's where you need to embed this if you want it to sustain over time. And so they've been very willing to partner with us and have taken on the role of the navigators, which Dina will talk about in a bit. Another key piece is the evaluator. While we did not start out with the current evaluator, we ended up with them, and it's been very fortunate. iChip, which is at the University of Florida, they are the state's EQRO. Everyone know what an EQRO is?
No,
all right. So in Medicaid, if the External Quality Review Organization, every state has to have one when they do managed care because they need that outside independent view of the quality of the program. So if you don't know who's yours is, find out, because they're the ones who touch the Medicaid data for the state. And so this particular EQRO has business in several states, and they have a very robust capability to understand Medicaid data and deal with Medicaid data. So we were fortunate to have them because, just one example, they were able to take administrative data for the area and identify who met the selection criteria and came up with some almost 13,000 people who met our study criteria. So we knew, okay, well, we can get a sample out of that. They know things about the MCOs. They've worked with them for years. They know the data. It's been very advantageous to us. And as you see the data and what they're looking at, you'll see what I'm talking about. But we didn't have a way to operate this, so a lot of the operations ended up with the EQRO. And they're not operating as an EQRO for us. They're the evaluator, but they have that dual role. And the Medicaid office knows them, and so that's been real useful. And they've also reached out to bring in people like Dr. Cook to help us and consult on some of the on-the-ground programs like the Wellness Recovery Action Planning and the component that I'll talk about in a minute, which is the Wellness Fund. And then our advisory group includes people like the county judge's office, which is a very important office in the county in Texas, the Mental Health America office of that area. They actually are running the RAP intervention for the project. So folks like that, the MCOs come to this group, and that's been very helpful to keep this project on track. So our interventions. What we did when we sat down, when this grant opportunity came out, we said, well, what do we know? What do we think would work? You know, it lined up with things we had been concerned about in terms of managing chronic disease in our state with our population who have behavioral health disorders. And so we took what we had learned from other projects we'd been working on and put it together into what we thought would be an intervention that might make a difference. So Dina had been involved in a big DMIE project, another big study that it used health navigators, and the data had indicated that was really a helpful thing. And as you all know, health systems are inherently complex, and it's amazing that people make it through those at all. And so health navigators can really help people access the benefits are there. And so that was one of the roles we wanted. And then another thing that they had learned in the previous study was how important motivational interviewing was and the need to have that done at a certain level of fidelity, that it really made a difference in how people approached the members and the kind of relationships they established with them. Then the other one was the effectiveness studies that Dr. Cook had worked on RAP had come out just shortly before we did this. And so this was another piece to look at how can people plan for their wellness. And so that was an intervention we put into this. And we had recently finished our self-directed care study that we did in the Dallas area, and had gotten real positive results out of that. And so we took a piece of that, which was the flexible wellness account that people could use to pay for trying to attain their health goals. And so we actually started out proposing that we could, you know, give them a $500 pot of money. Interestingly enough, when they reviewed the application, CMS came back and said, we don't think that's enough money. And so we put $1,150 a year in that account that they could have over and above their Medicaid benefit. So this is a supplemental kind of program that could be used to incentivize them and help them self-activate and implement their own personal plan for recovery and for wellness. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the evidence for the flexible accounts because some of you will already be familiar with cash and counseling, the research that was done on that, the self-directed care project, and again, I have to give a shout out to Judith and her staff. They evaluated that, and then our own project in the Dallas area where we'd done a randomized controlled trial of self-directed care. And so we felt like it was important to bring evidence-based practices into the intervention and ones that we had tried and had some sense of how to do. So that's exactly how we approach this. Let me give you an example of some of the allowed purchases, the kinds of things that are being purchased by people in this particular study. So there are lots of devices that help with wellness, so those were available. Transportation. Now, Dina mentioned the geography of this area, so and we found this in the Dallas area with our other work, that folks are stuck and limited as to their choice of where to go because of transportation. So if they're on a bus line, they might get to one clinic or one doctor. May not be the best one for them, but they don't have a lot of choices. And so people want to get to the people that they feel like really can help them. And so transportation to wellness kinds of activities and providers that you want become a real important piece of this. Obviously, having access to fitness activities is another thing that often folks aren't taking advantage of. And then there are things that this can pay for that isn't in the Medicaid benefit, as I'd said. One other thing I want to mention is that the family-based wellness training and intervention. One of the things that emerged out of this was that people talked about their family situation, and the navigators saw this. And so trying to eat healthy, and you live with a family who fries their food and doesn't cook in a way that's heart healthy, makes it very difficult to maintain that kind of lifestyle. And so involving the family became real important. In some cases, people said, well, look, is there a way that my family member could go with me to the gym, participate with me, or help me get somewhere? And so we talked about it and said, yeah, that should be an allowable thing in your wellness account. And so we've been able to incorporate that into this. The other thing, and Dina had mentioned this, there are parts of Houston and Harris County that are food deserts. And so having access to fresh fruits and vegetables is next to impossible. And having the money, as someone pointed out earlier, having the money to purchase those is incredibly difficult. So this is something that in this program people are able to do that they couldn't normally do. So at this point, I'm going to turn it back to Dina, who's going to talk about the design and the data we're collecting and kind of some of the preliminary results of the program.
Thanks, Sam. And that's twice that I haven't tripped over the cord. So I feel like my critical set the bar low on your critical success factors, and you'll be happy, right? So as I mentioned earlier, this is a very rigorous controlled trial, 1,600 people in comparison control and intervention groups. And we are doing annual collection of data on all three groups via survey. Additionally, the control group is contacted monthly. We keep up with them. We've had high engagement in this program and also high continued participation. This is a study of a population that usually people say is hard to reach, hard to engage, hard to keep. We've had less than 2% attrition, some of it tragically due to death, because people have very complex conditions and needs, some of it due to people losing Medicaid eligibility, but we haven't had a lot of it. We haven't had people dropping out of the study. That's the important thing. And people have stayed highly engaged in the interventions, even well into the study, people using the interventions, over 70% of the people continuing to access the flexible account, and over 90% of the people in the intervention group being seen within the study window. In other words, they're having that regular contact with their navigator. They're continuing that relationship. So navigators, again, as Sam mentioned, we're trying to embed this in the Medicaid delivery system. So while it would be easier for us to come in like gangbusters and hire a bunch of fancy-dancy people and then, you know, work alongside the plans, we wanted to work in the plans, with the plans. So the plans, going through the plans hiring process, the HMO is actually the employer of record. The University of Florida is overseeing fidelity to interventions and working with them and hiring subcontractors to work on that. Sam mentioned motivational interviewing. We learned in the DMIE stands for Demonstration to Maintain Independence in Employment. It was a study we did in the Harris area earlier, another very large study, over 1,600 people in that. We said motivational interviewing, that's going to be really important for health navigators. Let's do a class in motivational interviewing, you know. So we did that and did a refresher. And one of the things we learned is in that particular study, we had people of various backgrounds. We were trying to affect employment. We had vocational people who formerly had a lot of experience being vocational counselors. Some of them were a lot of social workers and some nurses. And some people had an empathetic style and others didn't. Others were good people but really couldn't relate. Whenever I explain motivational interviewing to general audiences, I always say it's easier to explain what it's not. You know, visiting my family physician, who's a really good guy, great with the data, the other day, I had gotten out of my mouth the words, I think my hip's bothering me a little bit. And before I could go any further, he said, you know, women your age have no business running. you know what I'd do if I were you? Be thankful for what you have, not for what you don't have. Here's some ideas. They're all evidence-based. Now, what do you think I did with that? In the garbage. So similarly, in that project, we had people who were very skilled at letting the individual take the lead, and other people who are like, you just need to get your hemoglobin A1C down. And I know we all spend a lot of time thinking about our hemoglobin A1C values and treasure that experience, but people in that program were not necessarily interested in that. They wanted to keep their job, be able to keep up with their kids, you know, feel healthy, feel engaged. Yeah, so what a surprise, no different than the rest of us. So anyway, so what we're doing in this project is extensive ongoing training and support. And even before that, in selecting the navigators, we have Scott Walters, who's a nationally recognized expert in motivational interviewing, works at University of North Texas, helped hire the people. So he was on the interviews, either on the phone or in person, and he did created situational questions for people and did a whole, you know, kind of little empathy, mini empathy review in the course of that. So we selected people who were amenable to learning this intervention, which is not intuitive for everyone. And it was a simple thing to do, and it's something that HMOs and other people could implement as part of their hiring process. So it has to go all the way back to the kinds of people you select, I think. And then extensive ongoing training, shadowing, with participants' permission, they record interviews, and then people, independent folks, score those interviews and give the navigators feedback about how they're doing. And it's not easy for everybody to do that balancing act. You always want to take charge, give advice. Letting somebody take the lead is difficult for people to do. In our professions. We're helping professions. We want to go help somebody, which is usually pretty didactic, and that's what we're trying to avoid. So anyway, they also get extensive training on our databases, which I'll talk about in a little bit, and their average caseload is 60 to 70 people. So this is not like an ACT team or something. We're trying to create something that's sustainable in a managed care environment that would more resemble a caseload for an intensive population that people would use so that you could do this in your plan. So again, as I said, we have continuous contact with the intervention group. They have a relationship with their navigator. They're seen at least quarterly face-to-face and monthly telephone contact at least. And technology really aids this process. Unlike the other projects, most of the other projects in the MIPCD are site-based. So, and that's good. You know, they're based in a clinic or they're based somewhere. This is a little bit different. We go out into the community. We don't have a clinic that people go to. We see them in their homes, their apartments, at McDonald's, for God's sake, if that's where people want to meet. And it's really had a great value for us and for our navigators in that it's not an abstract question. Why are people not, usually the question is, why are people not compliant with something? And this kind of approach lets you see what people are actually facing. What are they up against? What is their milieu, as they like to say in research land, right? And what we find is that people's lives are quite busy and engaged in trying to negotiate the health delivery system, as Sam mentioned, engaged in trying to keep and find stable housing. There may be chaos in their lives, multiple people coming in and out, lots of relationships, no real positive relationships, lots of smoke in the air, no quiet time, no me time, no time to reflect. And so when you put all of those things together with lack of transportation, crushing poverty, and the stigma that mental illness carries in our society, it adds up to, I got a lot of things on my checklist here. I'll think about hemoglobin A1C later. So it's been helpful, and that really it increases our ability to meet people where they are and understand what makes sense for them. So additionally, we use a debit card system through Bank of America for people to make their purchases. So the cards are loaded as people identify specific goals on their plan with their navigator and the devices, memberships, you know, goods and services that would help them achieve that. And having it through Bank of America, I'll steal a line from Judith, it's helpful in that it's not stigmatizing. It's what you and I would do. Many of these people have never had a bank account in their lives, and so this is all new for them. And it's really empowering. What would be less empowering than not having your credit card or something? God, you know, how would we cope on a day-to-day basis? You're almost like a non-citizen. So here's another advantage. And also, as Judith would say, it's not a big old card that says mental illness wellness program. So it's not like singling people out, like you have a target painted on your back or something. This is the same kind of thing that all of us would do. And that's what we should all aspire to. So initially and routinely, we go through a series, an assessment process. This is done in the person's home community as a conversation. And the iPad has some guided software in it that helps guide the conversation and also prompts, triggers when they identify different issues in their lives. It'll prompt some health risks so people can kind of think about those and say, maybe I want to do something about that, maybe I don't. We're able to collect demographic information and cognitive measures and all kinds of stuff very seamlessly through that, and it goes straight to the server at the University of Florida. So people's data isn't sitting out there on some machine, which is also a nice thing, and we get it immediately. So people are setting their own goals here in their own words. So while our goal might be that the person stop smoking, because all the statistics are grim and people are dying of heart disease and lung disease in great numbers, that might maybe not be the first thing I want to work on. I might want to work on increasing my activity level or something else. And so we let the person take the lead and articulate their goals. I want to be stronger so that I can walk down to the neighbor's house and play dominoes. Okay, you know, that's a goal. So we review, this is a living rapid cycle improvement project is what CMS calls it. Ironic for CMS, but you know, well, actually they've been wonderful in this process and we've had fantastic project officers. So I think it's a really encouraging sign that people have embraced the idea of, rapid cycle performance improvement. And they really have been quite helpful in the process. So it's encouraging. Anyway, the goals it's a living document. The goals are reviewed and updated regularly. So as people identify different things, new things that they want to do, we evolve toward those, and they can change what they're purchasing. So we have a lot of software. Clinical Conductor is a system that allows the navigators to track and manage their interactions and make sure that it allows us to track their productivity. Are they seeing people when they're supposed to see them, that kind of thing. And because they don't, they're not manually tracking all this, and they've got the software, it allows them to spend more quality time with people, which is helpful. At first, they didn't like it. There are a lot of social workers in this. I don't know. They use the software. And now they all love this. So, and then the WIN portal, which was created for this program by UF, where we do our intake assessments. Another cool thing about using this mobile technology and associating the information with geomapping and other technologies is that we can sit in somebody's house and say, okay, let's see, you've identified activity as a goal. How would you like to do this? Well, I've always wanted to join the Y. You know, my buddy down the street's at the Y. I'd like to do that. Oh, okay, great. Well, we'd press a button and tell people where are the YMCAs near their home? Where are the ones on the bus route? That kind of thing. So that's helpful. And this is something we're evolving as the program goes on. And people like the iPad. So we let people do consent forms and intake assessments and things like that on the iPad. And it's kind of fun for folks. They don't have a lot of technology. Some of them have cell phones, but typically, what you find in this population is pretty low income, so people are buying those month-to-month contracts and, you know, always a challenge. So we spend a lot of time and effort making sure we can keep track of folks. Okay, so we're looking at lots and lots and lots of data. We're not only looking at the encounter and claims data, which, as Sam pointed out, since we're using the External Quality Review Organization for Medicaid, we have all the Medicaid data. So we have their pharmacy data. We have their their physician data, if they're getting long-term care services, we know that, any mental health services paid for by Medicaid. We have all of that information already. So we can track and trend and look at all those wonderful things that people like to look at with administrative data, including, HEDIS measures. Some are more useful than others. We can look at potentially preventable admissions, readmissions, emergency department use, all of that. But we also look at a number of other things. I think the most important thing that we're collecting is the people's self-perception of where they are. We are looking at their goals and their progress toward achieving those goals as they perceive it. iCHIP's also collecting something called the patient activation measure, which isn't real person-first language, but what it does is it measures the person's self-perception of how important their actions are in maintaining their health and improving their health. Do I believe I have power to change my health? And the greater that power, the greater satisfaction people have with health delivery systems, the greater engagement, and the greater health. And this is true. We've done, I'm not intelligent enough to describe the relationship between all these variables, but iCHIP is also looking at cognitive measures, so they've done cognitive testing. And there are a lot of people with some real cognitive issues. But despite that, people can become activated. They can, if they believe that they can do something and they are seeing progress, they get better. And it's irrespective of, you know, what other cognitive issues you have or what ethnic group you're in. And so that's a hopeful sign. We hope that we see some good results from that. So we're looking at adherence to treatment, looking at lots and lots of things. Also, because it's the eQRO, we can seamlessly collect some of this data. For example, we look at satisfaction with the program. That's one of the parameters in the law. Are people satisfied with the program? Do they like it? Instead of slapping another survey on them, we use the CAHPS survey, which is the Consumer Assessment of Health Plan Services. That's a standard assessment that's done in managed care, and people get this assessment about every year in managed care programs. It's a big study sample. So we oversample this group. They add a few questions to it instead of doing a whole other thing. So trying to be less intrusive, and that's very helpful. So lots of data coming into the system. Okay. So what are we finding out so far? Again, the mean age of the population is they're middle-aged, 44. More females than males, which is pretty typical in these studies. We did a really good job of recruiting people, and we had a protocol. The National Opinion Research Center, or NORC, I always want to call it NARC, I don't know why, here at UIC, it has, is it UIC or is it? UFC, okay. UFC. U of C. Ooh, sorry. Okay. Some there was a U and a C in there. So for government work, it wasn't bad. So anyway, Some university, it's not in Texas, I don't know. It's somewhere on the prairie, you know, whatever. Anyway. And they had nothing better to do than call these people constantly, so they were a good choice for this. Actually, they, and they're certainly world-renowned for their ability to do telephonic recruitment, and they did a very good job. And we had a protocol additionally. We wanted to make sure that we didn't, I hate that term too, pick the low-hanging fruit. Somebody said how much they hate that. I hate that term too. Like, just get the people who are easy to get. So there was a protocol that made them keep trying, keep trying, keep trying. Okay, it worked, because about two-thirds of the people have severe mental illness alone or in combination with other physical or behavioral health problems. So we were trying to hit this population that's often not reached in studies, and we made it. The ethnic diversity reflected here is similar to the ethnic diversity in the Harris Service Delivery Area. It is a very diverse area. As I mentioned earlier, people have broken or non-existent relationships. They don't have social support systems that are very supportive. That's very typical in this population. Over 70% of the people are in the severe chronic clinical risk category, according to the claims and encounter data. So they have significant health issues. And as I mentioned earlier, cognitive impairment is an issue for people. So how are people doing? Well, the majority of people selected weight loss, eating habits, and reducing sedentary behavior is the things they really, really wanted to work on for various reasons. And the vast majority of them report that they're making progress on those goals. In their perception, they're doing better. And that's a really, really important thing. So, again, significant challenges here. You know, we've heard all this before, so I won't spend a lot of time on it. But like most of America, you know, weight is an issue for people, and there are a lot of people in the obese to morbidly obese category. That's easy to happen in Houston, where there aren't a lot of opportunities to walk unless you make them for somebody. And, you know, ironically, the things that are supposed to transport us from place to place, expressways, can hem in parts of the city and create islands for people who are economically disadvantaged. Here's what we don't do. We don't show them this. But... damn. So this is something my doctor would probably do. But he's a good guy, you know. It's anyway, I was at another conference last week, and we talked a lot about health silos. And I said, well, you know, I guess the nice thing about a project like this is people aren't siloed. Health systems are. So if you start with that person, their goals and objectives, that's one way of getting around silos of health. People identified weight management because they know intuitively all of these things are true. And more importantly than knowing the science behind this, they know what their experience is and they know what they want to accomplish. So if I want to be able to run to catch the bus faster or something, that's what I know. And that's what should be important here, not how much you weigh or whether... you have an interesting infographic about that. So, as you can see here, this is what people are spending on. A lot of things like gym memberships, exercise equipment, and cheap stuff. We have whole families doing Zumba. They'll buy a Zumba tape, and they love it. And it's something like it will spend millions of dollars on a hospital visit, but we won't spend $19.95. I'm sure that's what they cost, right, on some infomercial somewhere, on a Zumba tape, so which we should rethink. So what is our... do what? Shipping and handling. Oh, so it's more like, okay, pardon me, it's more like $21.59 or so, yeah, something like that, depending on your state sales tax, except in Alaska and Hawaii. Okay, so 5 minutes. Okay, so what have we seen? What we're seeing here is that people, an intervention relative to control, we've seen significant decline in tobacco use reported. Mental status is better. And that's a good thing because better mental status is better physical status, as we discussed yesterday. Lowered use of alcohol among people who said, yeah, that's a problem for me in the beginning. And people are more active. We don't know yet how it's going to affect Medicaid claims. So here's a typical example of somebody in the program. Jean was depressed, anxious, lonely. And most importantly, she felt completely disempowered. I don't know why I'm even trying. Nothing's going to change. Nothing's going to get better. She was obese and as a result of that had chronic knee pain and was heavily medicated for this and also was taking medication for mental illness. So she's in a fog. here, too, that's creating issues for her. And she had high blood pressure. So their strategies, again, the positive motivation, healthy diet, fruits and vegetables, learning about that and actually helping the person get to some of those resources, exercise videos, and crafting supplies. Crafting supplies, you say? Well, I always say, my husband says this, he says a sense of accomplishment is one of the most important things in life. That is health. And so people who start to feel better about themselves or want to feel better about themselves often want to create something lasting to share. And that explosion of creativity is a side benefit of these programs that we see. So here Jean is actually doing crafting. And again, this stuff is cheap, you know? So would you rather have an ED visit, you know, or would you rather buy some crafting supplies at Michael's? And somebody said, what do they do with their hands when they don't smoke? Well, here's an idea. You could make something. And this is what she wanted to do. So she's lost 30 pounds. Oh, this is as of the first year, a little less than the first year. And, of course, had a positive change in BMI. And most importantly, I think as importantly, no longer takes medication for knee pain. And so she's coming out of that fog. And I have other great examples, which if we had time, we would share, of people who, my favorite is a guy who didn't get out of the house for years and through motivational interviewing dealt with his anxiety and figured out what he wanted to do. He was smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. One of the interventions was to buy him Domino's. Anybody know in Texas, Domino's are a cultural phenomenon. So he wanted to get better so he could go out and play Domino's. He learned to go outside, interact with his neighbors, started playing Domino's, quit smoking, you know? So who knew? Domino's, just remember that. There's a domino effect from Domino's, evidently. So what are we doing about this? We're gonna conclude this study. But Sam mentioned SDC briefly, and if you don't know about the SDC pilot in Dallas, I think Judith and Sam did a great presentation on that here, what, last year? Yeah. One of the things we're looking at in terms of sustainability is unpacking some of the very successful components of these programs, one of which is the self-direction itself. And you say, well, how are you going to sustain $1,150 a year? That's a grant. Where's that going? I submit to you, we already have the money. We're spending it in a pretty hefty capitation rate. Yeah, and so we are with the enthusiastic participation of our Medicaid office and MCOs planning for a potential pilot in our fully integrated managed care product. We thought we'd give Houston a rest, so we'll be doing that in the Travis service delivery area, which is Austin and surrounding counties. So thanks so much, and we'll be happy to answer any questions. Sam will be taking any difficult questions. So.